Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And welcome to this latest episode of Q Commentator with me, Nick Heath. Well, this episode is one that's coming to you from within this curious period of worldwide lockdown and quarantine. But that's not something I'm going to dwell on, as you're not listening to this for anyone to be talking about that. One thing that has happened during this time is that I've achieved a bit of notoriety for putting out a few videos featuring my hammed-up parody commentary voice. That's been providing a bit of levity for anyone finding the current environment pretty challenging. It's been pretty incredible to see the messages from people who've been entertained or who found a belly laugh at the end of a challenging day, and pretty humbling too to receive them. So if you've ended up coming to Q Commentator as a recent follower or as a convert to our church, you are very welcome indeed. I guess one of the unique things about this period is that we don't have any actual sport taking place right now. So it's given me a good chance to catch up with one of the industry's busiest men. And also, I think, in commentary terms, one of the best examples, if not the best example, of a multi-sport commentator. I am talking, of course, about the excellent Andrew Cotter. In this episode, we'll briefly cover how Andrew started out before discussing his prodigious career as a commentator on so many sports, from the boat race to Wimbledon, rugby union, golf, athletics, more besides. There's a mention of Olive and Mabel, because obviously I wanted to hear about Andrew's dogs. And we also cover that unfortunate moment when Andrew had to leave his post due to norovirus whilst on air. I think we cover it in such a way that it shouldn't turn your stomach or make you lose your lunch. It is an amazing tale. So, listen, Andrew's a very self-effacing man, so I was really thrilled that we managed to find the time and that he was open and engaging with me in wanting or allowing me to get under the skin of what he does and how he does it. So I hope you'll appreciate that too. So hello again. It's lovely to be back with you. I'm hoping to collar a few more people during this time, given that, commentators haven't got a lot else to do unless you're doing the sort of inane rubbish that I am online. Hopefully a few more people can come out the woodwork and we can get a few more episodes done. But for now, I shall say little more than I hope you enjoy this one. Well, Andrew Cotter, thank you very much for joining me. It's been a little while since the last Q Commentator chat. Delighted to have you with me. How are you?
I'm all right. I'm all right. That's all we can say at the moment, is we're all right. I'm fine. I'm fine.
Indeed. Yeah. We are recording this at curious times.
Strange times. Yeah, strange times to be a sports broadcaster. You think sport is always going to be there, and then suddenly it's not. And you realise how trivial it always was, but somehow very important it was to all of us as well. So there we are.
Yeah, there certainly is that feeling. So a man from Troon, west coast of Scotland, golfing country, University of Glasgow, studying French and philosophy. I did French sociology and law, albeit for 6 months in Preston before I ran away. and then it all began in radio. Why and how were you drawn to working in local radio to start with?
I'd love to say it was the end of a long quest and long-held desire to be a broadcaster and to work in radio or then television or whatever, but it wasn't. It was it was a case of, and this is what many people experience, I didn't really know what else to do, and I just sort of fell into it a little bit. I had, as you say, a degree in French and philosophy, which qualifies you for nothing at all. being a help on holidays or trips and being pretentious. I don't know. I had a love of languages.
I'm excellent at both of those.
Yeah, exactly. We're all very good at that. And it's, I knew I wanted to work with language, with words. I was working as a waiter in a cocktail bar. And I was working as a waiter in a restaurant after university just to pay the bills in Glasgow. And it was a sort of media hangout, this restaurant, Regano in Glasgow. And lots of media types would come in, and they always seemed to be leading the high old life. And I thought, that's the life for me. I don't know. Yeah. I just sort of fell towards it. And local radio, I applied for a couple of jobs, one with written journalism, one in broadcast journalism. And I got offered both of them, and then just took the broadcast journalism route because it seemed to be a little bit more glamorous and exciting to a 22-year-old. So that was it.
I mean, with you sort of mentioning the media types and the glamour and the excitement, had you been someone drawn to any sort of form of performance in your youth, in your past? Had you done sort of drama at school or anything like that?
No, I was, in fact, and strange given the job I do now, and, you know, when you're doing commentary or when you're doing event hosting, whatever, you are, performing. But
yeah.
I was the only person who didn't take part in school productions because I had such fear of embarrassment of being up there in the limelight. So I steered away from it. I had a strange desire, there's this sort of paradox of wanting to perform but not wanting to be stared at too much or laughed at too much. So it was it was torturous. I remember when Trainspotting came out, and it was such a sort of pivotal film at that time, and I was at university at the time, and I don't know, it seemed to be that I thought, oh, that would be fantastic to be an actor. Wouldn't it be great to be Ewan McGregor? But I had no... But also my...
I think we all thought that at the time, to be honest.
Well, yeah, exactly. And then my father worked in television. He was a director of all sorts of programmes. And he said, don't do it. Actors are weird. I said, well, I'm kind of weird. And he said, it's such an insecure life, and they are such insecure people. I'm sure they aren't all insecure people, but you've got to have something slightly outre to be an actor. And I didn't have that. I don't know, the next best thing. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, was there a plan then when you sort of got into radio? Did you get into that and think, right, okay, so this is the broadcast journalism thing. This is definitely the start of a journey which is going to take me to X, mountaintop or whatever.
literal mountaintops. I like that. There was certainly, as soon as I started to do it, then I got more serious about it and thought, right, okay, I really do enjoy this and I really do want to do this. But it wasn't a grand plan then saying, right, I want to, you just always want, you always want to improve, and you have such drive and ambition when you're younger in particular that, yes, I definitely wanted to move on, and I didn't want to be, bless it, I didn't want to be at Scott FM for the rest of my days. Well, it didn't last very long anyway, Scott FM, but I wanted to broadcast on more sports. I wanted to broadcast on a bigger stage. And yes, you end up having to go to London because in Scotland at the time, certainly it was so football concentrated that, and it is quite a goldfish bowl that, yes, you want to be, watched by more people and you want to be on the bigger stage. So there's certainly that, but there wasn't a grand plan. It was just, right, let's keep doing this, keep enjoying it, and let's see where it takes us.
Yeah, and in terms of then, obviously, broadcast journalism can cover a number of different things, but sport was obviously figuring pretty highly.
Yeah, it was actually a news job that I first applied for in local radio, but they saw I had a lot of sport in my CV. I mean, I wanted to be a golfer when I was younger until I realised I wasn't nearly good enough, and then...
I was going to ask about your sporting pedigree.
No sporting pedigree. I love playing sport, and I would still rather play sport than watch sport or commentate on sport. I still love, sporting activity. The older you get, the less you can do. But I was always
about... And in terms of solo stuff, team stuff, have you got a preference on your preferred sports to knock about with?
I'm pretty antisocial, although you can hide in a team environment slightly. I know that's not why most people do team sports, because you can hide. They do it for the social aspect of it and do it for the team bonding. But, golf was my thing, and it was, you know, it was all on you. And when it's all on you and you're like me, then you're absolutely screwed, because this, my psychology is absolutely dreadful, right. Yeah. In terms of, and golf's the worst.
Down.
Yeah, and it's the worst sport to find you out, golf. So whereas, you know, you could have a slightly off day playing football or playing rugby, and you might get carried along by the rest of the team, or they can pick you up mentally. So I understand more the attraction of team sport, but I always quite like doing things on my own as well. So yeah, that's what I was drawn to.
Do you think it's
permissible? Sports.
Yeah. Do you think it's permissible for a commentator to allow himself the insight at top level sport that comes from having played it at an amateur level, like from knocking about, for example, you know, like you say, the sort of mental destruction you can cause yourself as someone out on the 17th green. Can you put some of that in there?
No.
To someone who's doing it for the Masters?
I mean, a tiny, tiny, tiny amount, but they are totally different creatures and play on a totally different level and play almost a totally different game. So even when you played it, and I was quite good at golf, but when you've played it, you know, so you can have an appreciation for how brilliant they are, but you cannot, even if you played top level amateur golf, you can't imagine what it's like to be standing, you know, second shot in the 15th of the Masters coming down the stretch or whatever. It's not, you're right, it gives you an appreciation, I suppose, for how good they are, but it doesn't give you an insight into what they're feeling or how they're going to hit this shot, because they'll be able to hit the shot that you just wouldn't be able to hit.
Yeah, yeah, fair enough. So when did commentating then first figure on the scene?
Well, commentary would, I mean, when I was working at local radio, we didn't have any rights at Scott FM to any of the matches, so I didn't do any commentary. You're presenting bulletins and it was quite good in a way, because you're learning to edit, to do interviews, to do the whole package, to produce as well as report and present. So that by the time you went to areas where you're able to specialise more and just be a broadcaster, then, you know, you have an appreciation for the sort of skills of everyone else as well and the work that goes into it. But there was no commentary. So commentary first happened when I came down to London to work for, I was freelancing for Sky News and for Five Live. And Five Live let me loose on, in 2000, let me loose on a rugby commentary on Sports Plus, as it was, which became Sports Extra. Okay. And then just a couple of months later, they let me do on the same station, just because it was a great outlet for trying out new voices, Sports Plus, Sports Extra. And so I got to do...
Because
nobody could find it. Nobody was listening to it. But there was money invested in it at the time. So we even covered things like the World Match Play at Wentworth, and I went down there. That was my first golf commentary. So that's when I started, and you were kind of thrown into it a little bit, and it was right, let's just see what you can do, because we're not risking you on sort of the main station at the moment. Let's just see if you can do this.
And were there voices that you emulated growing up? Were there people that, you know, I mean, there's obviously on a rugby front, there's a bit of a Scottish grandfather overlooking, I imagine, any Scotsman who wants to get involved in doing any rugby commentary, which Bill McLaren, for those people listening who might not know who I'm talking about, obviously. But were there voices you emulated or were wary of you know, mimicking?
Well, that's the key thing. You shouldn't mimic somebody. You should always take in what they do and how they do things and listen to and appreciate it. I think when you're growing up watching a lot of sport, and I was watching a huge amount of sport, like most youngsters growing up, I was watching them all, and all of that is probably seeping in a little bit, whether it's Peter Alice or Bill McLaren or David Coleman or Barry Davis. It's all just feeding into you. So by osmosis, you are taking all this on board. And whether you realise it or not, that is becoming your template for being a commentator as well. But at the same time, you have to be yourself. And, you know, Bill's from the heart of the borders, or Bill's from the heart of the borders, and Hoyk, and I'm, you know, totally different type of voice from the west of Scotland. So and it would sound ridiculous if you... And yes, Bill had a lovely voice. He had a great delivery. He had a wonderful turn of phrase. He had, a lot of... sort of metaphors in there and similes and but if you try to ape that, it would say, oh, there's the poor man's Bill McLaren. So be yourself and do, you know, I would say I'm a different type of commentator. But what you can have, that all, you know, good commentators have, what you can try and have is that same appreciation for the sport and a nice turn of phrase, however it's delivered. Just having a turn of phrase and appreciation for the moment and the drama or the the lightheartedness of it if it's required.
Yeah.
And you know, whether you're you know, wherever you come from, whatever your accent is, whatever your background, those are the sort of common threads I think that run through good commentators.
Yeah, I totally agree. And so as you're jobbing then through you know, Sports Plus, and then I imagine the five live gigs started coming as well at that point.
Yeah.
What was the first sort of big event that started coming into view that you saw your name being attached to and was like, oh, hello?
Well, I remember I was supposed to join the golf team and the radio for the 2001 Ryder Cup, which was then, of course, 9/11 happened and it was put back to 2002, back into the even years, and who knows, all that might change. But so I remember getting excited about that, and then I suppose the Rugby World Cup in 2003. I remember first of all getting my rota for the 2001 Six Nations, because I was doing that on BBC Radio, and I was on BBC Radio, you know, they did a lot of them on BBC Radio 4 at the time, Longwave.
Oh, okay.
So because that was freed up, and so I was doing Scotland, Wales, or I remember doing that with commentating with Andy Irvine. I think Ellie Oldroyd might have been presenting, and just hearing the Radio 4 continuity announcer saying, and commentary from Murrayfield will come from Nick Mullins, Andrew Cotter, and your presenter, Ellie Oldroyd. And it was just, there we go. It's quite a thrill, and it seems strange. But I don't know, when you've grown up watching...
Well, it doesn't need to feel strange, does it? I mean, I think those are the moments that you work towards, aren't they? And when you're then started to be placed in those... amongst the names of people that you've respected or on stations and introduced in that way, certainly I think that's there's probably still a thrill.
Yeah, and when you've grown up watching the Six Nations as well, or Five Nations, and growing up watching that and these events, and suddenly you're commentating on them, you should never lose that appreciation. You become a bit before all this, I became a bit blasé about it all. You know, doing this event again, doing this event again. You should never take it for granted, because what a privilege it is to be sitting there, and this sounds terrible, but being the Bill McLaren or whoever it might be for people watching now. I mean, things have changed a huge amount in terms of there isn't one voice of a sport as there was back then. But it's still what a privilege it is to help bring sport into the sitting rooms of people around the country.
Yeah, absolutely, and. You then sort of were working across various sports, I guess, as you bedded in, I guess, with Five Live. Were you staff at the BBC for a while then?
Oh, I was for a long time, yeah. So I was initially freelance, I went down, and then I got offered a staff job. And a staff job at the BBC was seen as, you know, that's the holy grail, because it was such it seems like an entirely different world, and it was a very different world. And I was just arriving at the BBC at the end of the days of Milk and Honey, where you know, the BBC was very well funded, and Sky had come in the early 1990s, and it changed the landscape. But it hadn't changed to the extent that it has now, and the BBC still had the rights to almost everything, and it was still very,
well,
very
Sky
well
blew
funded
football
in terms,
up, didn't they? But the rest of it,
well, exactly,
to a degree, but.
Yeah, and if you did sport in the BBC, it was very, very well funded, and you know, things are understandably far more tightly controlled financially now, and certain sports have borne the brunt of it as well in being cut back. But at that time, it was just very, very exciting to be doing sport at the BBC, and to be given a staff job. It was security as well, and you knew that, because if you got a staff job at the BBC, if I had stayed staff, you're staff for life. It takes away a lot of possibilities, and that's why you eventually go freelance again. But it brings a huge amount of security. So to be, you know, I it's the excitement. I remember getting my first HR letter from BBC saying, we are pleased to be offering you the salary of 20 shillings a year for all this stuff. And it was so exciting, and so I was staff for a long time until 2011, 2012. So I had
sort of
12 years.
That versatility then that came to you. Sorry to interrupt. Part of the nature of being on our online conversation is, I think, a slight delay. But you then obviously got the chance through the BBC to work on loads of stuff, and I think that as a staffer at the BBC certainly if we were to turn back time, I think, you know, for me, would absolutely be a dream job, because you will get put onto different things, and you're there just to commentate on what comes up. And
yeah,
and I think, you know, versatility can be an athlete's undoing, but your ability to commentate on a wide range of sports and events has I think become very much your USP, from tennis to golf to rugby, as you've mentioned, athletics, the boat race,
yeah,
probably some obscure Olympic events in there as well.
There have been some, yeah.
I mean, that must have those years and the opportunity to have done all those things, many of which you still do via a freelance contract, must have just given you so much satisfaction to be able to dip between them all.
Well, yes, and it's interesting. I was listening to your chat with Mike Costello, who's just a brilliant broadcaster, and so many of the things that he said rang true. And I remember he said that he was offered a job, you know, doing cricket, and that he couldn't back himself to have the knowledge or the passion for it that he did for boxing or for athletics. Yeah. And I would never say the Olympic sports, when I wasn't doing athletics, I wasn't doing the opening ceremony at Olympics, then I was offered, you know, weightlifting or modern pentathlon, and they're different because they're ones that they needed commentators at the time. You knew it's just a short-term fill, so you would brush up on them and get absolutely ready for them and hopefully be a decent enough commentator on them for that moment.
I was asked to do the championship cycling, and I felt by the time I'd finished it and I'd sort of genned up over the 2-3 weeks I had in a build-up, I sort of felt like it was my metaphor for it was a bit like babysitting, and all I know is the baby didn't die, but was I the best parent for those few hours? You know, not so sure, but we got through it, and I hit the right notes and called the right people over the line. So that's,
exactly. I mean, in 2012, which was obviously the enormous Olympics for all of us, and that was the year before I started doing athletics, and I would love to have done athletics in London, but it just it came too soon. I was doing sprint canoeing as one of the things, and I remember Ed McKeever getting his gold medal at Eton Dorney, and it was a brilliant race, and the atmosphere was incredible, and I had done a huge amount of work to get ready for that, and then you feel like a bit of a charlatan and a bit of somebody just dropping in for a moment on a sport, because this is their real passion, and I would totally understand that. But hopefully I would, you know, also be able to, on the BBC, bring that sport to the masses. And it sounds really grand, but bring it to them in a very excited way. And yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, to go back to the original question on the sports that I mean, golf and rugby were always my two main sports. But then I was asked to do tennis, and I have loved tennis. You know, I loved growing up watching Wimbledon, and so I was asked to do that, and I thought, yeah, of course I would love to do that. And then athletics had probably been an even bigger passion of mine for a long, long time. I mean, again, it's the era you grew up in. Growing up in the era of, you know, Alan Wells and Daley Thompson and Coan Ovett and Tessa Sanderson and Fatima Whitbread, whoever it might be. If I didn't mention Steve Cram, he'll kill me. But Steve Cram as well, all these people. So
that's very difficult to pin down for Q commentator.
He would be great. He's fantastic.
Yeah,
that would
on the list.
Yeah, yes, you will get him. So they were, you know, I loved athletics, and getting to commentate in athletics was such a thrill. But I often wonder if, you know, are you spreading yourself too thinly? Do people then say, jack of all trades, master of none? What's his expertise in this sport if he's suddenly then doing this sport? But hopefully. People just say, well, it's just a sort of continuation of the lineage of Barry Davis. Or David Coleman did football as well as athletics. Harry Carpenter did many, many sports. But, you know, boxing was his speciality. But that multi-sports broadcaster, that role has kind of dwindled.
Well, I think you're the last of that breed.
Well, there are some who do, on radio, who do a couple of sports, certainly. And, you know, look at Mike Costello doing athletics and boxing. So there might be people who do two, I suppose. Alistair Bruce Ball, John Murray would do golf and football.
Yeah.
I mean, there are others. Nick Mullins does tennis, and rugby. Yeah. And Nick would do a lot of sports as well. So there are some, but you're right. It's far more now. It's about having someone in a sport who is an expert. And indeed, a lot of the commentators now are ex-sportsmen and women. And you know, I always felt that there should be and actually you mentioned Steve Cram there, and he's someone who has become a brilliant broadcaster.
Well, the BBC have always been I think, the leaders in taking athletes and probably more so back in the day, putting the hours in and training them properly. You know, even if you look at people who present now very well, Gary Lineker, when he first started, was probably pretty terrible.
He worked hard at it. You know, Claire Balding's background was coming in from horses. She wasn't a top level, but she worked very, very hard. You know, perhaps she might have initially got
Jonathan
her chance.
Edwards as well.
Exactly.
These various people that have gone on to host things become lead commentators. Rory Lawson now, who does it on Rugby Union. There's a lot of them. I mean, to sort of look at a couple of the sports you do, golf perhaps against an athletics race, one of the sort of, I guess, more exciting ones. Two hugely different styles. Are there moments in the calendar where going from one to another needs a sort of proper mental reset, or do you just do the prep, pick up the mic, and you're there and you're ready to go?
Yeah, you can. I compartmentalize quite well in that, you know, 1 week, as you say, golf. I mean, the four sort of main sports: golf, tennis, rugby, and athletics are all very, very different in terms of the pace of them, in terms of how much you're saying or how little you're saying. I suppose rugby and athletics would be the most similar in terms of pace and stadium noise and that kind of cadence, whereas golf is just bouncing along a little bit, unless it's the Ryder Cup. It gets very exciting, and there are exciting moments within golf, but it's far more test match special level of chat commentary. And then tennis on television, I mean, again, what a huge difference between radio and television, because tennis on radio is non-stop, whereas tennis on television is the commentary where you say least of all. In fact, the main points where you're saying things are at the change of ends. You know, you're not saying anything during the point. You might come up with an exclamation and just a brief observation about his forehand. But that's for the co-commentator to do, really. So tennis is, what can I add in this tiny little window here? And what am I going to talk about? What are we going to talk about at the change of ends? Whereas rugby and athletics would be more fast-paced. And golf is just, you've got so much information that you have to have at your fingertips, because it's a long, slow, drawn-out commentary. And you've got to be entertaining as well as informative. So, yeah, they're all very different skills.
Yeah. On the change of ends at tennis, then, would you actually be off mic during any points? I guess you're concentrating on the point, but would you have a moment with a co-com to say, oh, let's talk about the percentage of first serves in at the change or whatever?
Yes.
Would you have a moment to... You would, right, okay.
Yeah,
it's on the list to try and get into, but yeah, okay.
Well, it is interesting because Hawkeye will be on the buttons to you during a game saying, so you're looking at a preview screen, they're showing you, okay, we're just going to show you where the forehand placement's going or percentage of serves to each corner of the serving box. And so they say, do you want to look at that? And I will sort of look at that, and I'll say to Boris Becker or Tim Henman or John McEnroe, I'll just say, do you want to have a look at that at the next change of ends? And they'll look at it, and because they're the experts, and they'll say, yeah, it's not really relevant at the moment, or let's have a look at that. Then I'll get in the talk back and say, yep, we're going to do that at Hawkeye, and then Hawkeye will go to the director and say, we're going to do this at the change of ends, and then the director will say, I'm afraid not, Sue's going to take us around the outside courts at the change of ends, so all plans go out the window. But yes, you're thinking about what you're going to chat about, and you might just scribble something down.
Well, talking of scribbling, I mean, talking about prep time, how does it differ? And certainly, you know, rugby's been my dominant work to date, and you'll script the top a little bit in the team boards, and then you're into the match. And how much scripting will you do? Have you written any bits of lines, knowing that you're going to need to find the right phrase if a world record goes on an athletics track or this kind of thing? How does it work for you?
You're spot on. You do write some things down. You write some phrases. You write a couple of lines that you think might work in a certain situation or certain outcome, because you know. So for every rugby match, I would write a little line. So if Scotland are playing France, I would say, write a little line. If England were to win the Scotland France match, would be weird. But if France were to win.
Say, I
hadn't prepared for this. What's going on? So you write a little line, but then it might absolutely go out the window because it's not relevant, because it's been a terrible game, or because it's been a brilliant game, or because something dramatic has happened that just isn't relevant for that line. So however nice the line might be that you have prepared, be prepared to bin it as well. Much though it pains you, you think, oh, that was going to be so good. But if it doesn't work, if it doesn't fit, don't use it, because there are a few things worse than a sort of clunking line that people go, ah, right, there he goes. How many script meetings were there over that line? And you're just really crowbarring it in.
If people can hear your homework, you're not doing it right.
Yeah.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
So one of my dogs is barking a pre-prepared line clearly in the background that she just wanted to get in. So I mean, I remember...
What are the dogs' names?
Olive and Mabel. So that was Olive, who was came up with the right phrase at the right time there. I remember doing the Rio Olympics, doing Wade Van Niekerk's world record, and not that you knew how it was going to play out, but you knew the three main protagonists in Karani James, LaShawn Merritt, and Wade Van Niekerk himself. And Van Niekerk was on the outside in lane nine, as was, and... So you kind of are prepared for example, the fact that he's going to be running blind. He's going to have nothing outside him but the crowd. And inside, LaShawn Merritt and Karani James will be chasing him down. So you can think of a line. You know that's going to happen. So you can think of a line, you know, barring a miracle. But if someone, you know, someone pulls a hamstring or whatever, then all bets are off.
Yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, I would say 90% of what you, more than that even, is just you observing and coming up with something on the spot and commentating. But part of it as well is thinking of a nice phrase for the middle of the race, a nice little line just to put in there. But again, you've got to be so strong enough to say, it's just not going to work there, and so jettison it. No matter how nice the line was, it's gone.
Indeed.
Consigned to the ether, and you let it go.
Yeah, and you're a beautifully self-effacing chap. But what moments have you looked back on so far? Or you know you might not be that sort of man either to look back too much. But what moments perhaps through your career so far have you enjoyed, or have you sort of walked away as you put the mic down and thought that went well? I think I nailed that.
I mean, 99% of the time I come away going, oh, I could have done that better. I think most of the time you're just thinking, I need to just keep this above a bar of quality that you're satisfied with it. Because if you come away going, absolutely hammered that, then you're a weird person. But there have
but there
been, I've
be
done
those
it.
One or two.
No,
minutes.
Yeah, of course. There are, well, I remember Tiger Woods chipping in at the Masters in 2005, and I was doing that for radio, and I was right beside the 16th. And so there's very famous Vern Lundquist commentary. He was a CBS commentator in America, which is played over and over again. And it was a lovely bit of commentary. I was commentating for radio at the time, and I remember thinking, you know, I got that. I was quite pleased with that commentary. I don't know if you remember Wales against Scotland in 2010, where Scotland were leading remarkably by they were leading by 7 points. No, they're leading by 10 points. With 4 minutes to go, and they lost by 7 which takes some doing. But it was such a dramatic game, and it was such an amazing comeback. And the atmosphere in the Principalities, in the Millennium Stadium, as was that day, was just incredible. But I was pleased with it because I think I did it quite well. But I was pleased with it because I was as excited for Wales winning, or I certainly sounded as excited as I would for Scotland coming, because that's a key thing for me as well. It's to be neutral. But yeah, so there have been what I've enjoyed some Ryder Cups as well, where the commentary's gone well. But yes, most of the time it's just, whew, got away with that one. Thank you and good night. Put the microphone down.
Yeah, where's my cup of tea? What have been the most challenging then on the other sort of end? What might you prefer not to hear back? Are there any that stand out?
Yes, but I'd probably consign them to the deepest recesses of my memory. They will only be brought out under hypnosis. Or I mean, I'm sure if I were to stop and think about this, I would be able to think about. I remember Florian Fritz and, I mean, these are minor things, but I remember Florian Fritz and David Marty, the two French centres, had swapped jerseys, one had gone 12, one had gone 13. I remember getting a try scorer wrong. That's the only time I've got a try scorer wrong. I remember them scoring. And you get down about that because on radio you can cover up. You can pretend that suddenly, David Marty just popped up in the move at the very end there. No one's going to be any wiser until they watch the highlights on television. So, of course, there have been plenty where I've got things wrong. I've got a couple of things wrong in it. I've got a couple of things wrong in all sports. There's no doubt about that. But I think they do stay with you. There's no doubt about that. Yeah.
It's a theme. A Q commentator actually is finding out that there's an element of wanting every commentary to be perfect, but also all of us having to understand no commentary is ever going to be perfect. Learning to forget and get past those moments.
Yeah,
but they're still going to be there, and they're still going to rancor a certain amount.
And the hardest part of it all now is that we all know that social media is a wonderful and dreadful thing at the same time. And I would rather not do it at all. But you're told, well, you should do it really for, if you're a freelance broadcaster, you've got to do it for profile sometimes, whatever. But there is instant judgment on your commentaries. And when you come off and you know you've got something wrong, and then you find out that people are saying, oh, you got that wrong on Twitter or whatever. I didn't get anything, I would like to think I didn't get anything wrong at the opening ceremony for the Olympics in Rio, but it's such a long broadcast with so many people watching, and there is so much scope for offending people when you're bringing in 205 countries to the stadium, and you've got to say something interesting about the history or the geopolitical status of that country, then people are just come off and there are 250 mentions on Twitter. And people going on about, Andrew Cotter's going on about the colonial past of a certain country. Well, I'm just saying why they didn't compete in the Olympics until 1972. You just give facts, but people just say, oh, God, he goes on about Christopher Columbus Columbus didn't discover Dominican Republic, Andrew. Think about it. I know, but he was in terms of, I don't know, it's just awful. So it's... because you're always hard enough on yourself, but now everybody else weighs in and is hard on you as well. So it's interesting medium.
I'm now dreaming up a scenario I'd like to enjoy, which is you talking back to yourself doing the opening Olympic ceremony,
Exactly.
Being the armchair person listening to yourself. Shut up.
I know.
There was obviously a minor memorable moment at the Stadio Olimpico in 2013.
Oh, God.
Italy against Wales. For people who don't know, we handed over to Andrew in the commentary box. I can't remember actually. I haven't done my research enough to remind myself how many minutes you lasted.
3 minutes 55.
Was that all? Three minutes 55, and then it became apparent that Andrew was indisposed, shall we say? And Jonathan Davis, who was co-commentator that day, then startlingly had to jump in and become lead commentator. You were a little unwell.
I was unwell. Well, the weird thing was, so 10 minutes before kickoff, I was absolutely fine. 5 minutes before kickoff, before the anthems, I started to feel that, that really cold feeling that you think, I might be feeling a little bit sick here. And then during the anthems, I said to Jonathan, I might be struggling here. And he thought I was joking, so he was just, whatever, you'll be fine. So yeah. I thought I was hoping that the adrenaline of the game would kick in and just get me going. But it was awful. I remember the first couple of minutes just trying not to be sick. And wow. I'd like to stress it was just being sick. There was nothing else going on, as lots of Welsh fans have subsequently and indeed still point out to me. I was just being sick. But anyway, I thought, well, if I can just get through this, but there was no way. And I thought, I've got to get out of here. Yeah. Because if I'm sick on air, then that really is. That's a viral YouTube sensation career ender. So I just put down the mic. You can hear the thump of the mic on the table after about 3 minutes 55. And I just disappeared. And the director was saying to the floor manager, "Is Andrew? Where's Andrew?" And the floor manager was saying, "Yeah, he's gone." he's gone. So yes, I was down in the bowels of the stadium again. I stressed. Just being sick.
Unfortunately, phrase to brought back given the rumours you're trying to scotch here.
The rumours that I'm trying to quash here. I was really, really ill. And strangely, the stubbornness and the determination.
Did you make it to wherever you needed to get to?
No, I didn't. Not in time, no. Oh. I went in through the presidential suite as well, and there were all these statuesque models, as it being Italy, to welcome VIPs into the presidential suite. But I knew that the nearest loo was the other side of the presidential suite. And they were saying, "Oh, buongiorno, signor, how are you?" And I sort of would indicate that I wasn't particularly well by projectile
I'm about
vomiting.
To technicolor yawn.
Yeah, oh, it was awful. It was absolutely awful. And then I came back up at half time and thought, maybe I can see myself through this. And the floor manager said, "Andrew, you're greeny grey." And so I went back down again, was ill for the whole game. Eventually, I was taken down by the medics and was given these anti-nausea injections.
Wow.
And that was it. Yeah, so good times. Good times in the Stadio Olimpico. Which I will always remember. And lots of other people will as well. So
Do you know what caused it, by the way? Was it just
It was the norovirus. It was a winter vomiting bug.
Right. Poor thing. But memorable nonetheless. So talking about your voice then, how would you describe it now?
My voice? I don't know.
It's a little challenge for you.
I don't know. It changes, I suppose, because it changes depending on what your broadcast is. So if I would, if you're doing I do some ad voiceovers or narration or whatever, and then, it depends, again, what they would want as well. Sometimes it is, sell your product with Andrew Cotter's voiceover. But in commentary terms, you're really ramping it up to something much more exciting, which I'm not going to do here. But of course, and it's interesting, listening to Mike talking about that.
Yeah, sorry. You're
it's a change of gears. Well, it's exactly. Someone like Eddie Butler would be more bass. He'd be a baritone, and I would be more a tenor, I suppose. And it's just it's again. If you were to analyse the craft or whatever of commentary, it's having that change of gear to fit the change of gear of the event in front of you. So, I would imagine it does get quite squeaky high when I get excited. But, I remember Mike talking about that, when he's doing the boxing as well, and how... I've done this in athletics races a couple of times where I've actually, I think I'm about to pass out here. I've gone far too early and far too high. I've gone into fifth gear and rein it back in, Andrew. Rein it back. Just dial it down a little bit. Because it's all about, because if you haven't got anywhere else to go, then it sounds just ridiculous and you're screeching for a while. So it's all about the pace. If you look at the sound graph on a sound wave and the graph and you see it just moving up nicely, then you've done it well. But if you're flatlining at the top early on, then it's no good for anybody.
Yeah, absolutely. And is it something that you warm up? Do you do anything to get yourself there? Speaking to John Hunt, obviously, Paradise by the Dashboard Light, featured in some of his ahead of some of his big race meets.
Oh, okay. He's brilliant. He's absolutely brilliant. I mean, and he picks his as they go across the line. That's kind of what you're looking for, as a horse goes across the line or as a runner goes across the line, that you are absolutely. And it's I enjoyed Doha, actually. This, you talk about a couple of the races, what have you enjoyed doing? Doha, the crowds were terrible, but the races, some of the distance races were brilliant. And I remember the men's 3,000-metre steeplechase and Conseslus Kipruto winning a title and just take it on the line from, I've forgotten his name now, Ethiopian. Anyway, it's Kenya against Ethiopia. And it was by millimetres, over 3,000 metres. And then as they cross the line, it's that ecstasy of explosion of noise. And then it just as they collapse to the track, your voice dies away with them. Because that's it. It's, I mean, there is a, I'm sure there is some sort of explosion way of putting it in graphic terms, but it is that, and then it just it dies away and
climactic.
Well, you're having a cigarette 10 seconds after the race. It's just, but it's making it match those moments, match the as I say, the sport in front of you. So I would not warm up my voice. I know I always try and take a sort of lozenge just to make sure that things are, whether it was once a Strepsil, now these things called Vocal Zone, which are they just protect your voice a little bit, because I never used to think about it, but I have lost my voice a couple of times due to having had a cold or whatever, and the day before doing a match you're thinking, I might not be able to do this, and again you know, you really want to do the commentary and you're thinking, actually my voice is quite important to me, so protect it as a singer would protect their voice, because if you don't have, you know, a commentator without a voice is well, nothing. So you've got to look after it, and I probably don't look after it quite as much as I should.
Yeah, giving up those woodbines will help, certainly. I know what you mean. I've had a couple of horribly timed winter or Six Nations colds, and it's straight onto the steamer the week as soon as you feel the first tickle going.
Yeah,
I've just got to get through. And I actually had one. I did a Pro 14 game in the autumn, and the voice was on its way, but I managed to basically not say anything, drinking ginger tea and steaming for a good couple of days.
Yeah,
got to the game, did the game, did the full 80, walked the 5 minutes around the corner to the Holiday Inn, walked up to the counter, and they said, "Can I have the name, please?" And I went,
Gone, absolutely.
The adrenaline and everything, and my preservation had got me through the 80, but beyond the full-time score, there was nothing.
I've been there.
It was really interesting. What do you think is the key to becoming a good commentator, and who do you think out there's doing the God's work, doing the Lord's work?
I mean, first of all, you've got to have a passion for sport, obviously. You've got to have a good voice, I think, as well. So, I mean, some people might be potentially brilliant commentators but don't quite have the voice, and vice versa. There'll be people with a voice who don't have the other skills. You've got to be prepared to work a lot as well, because as everybody everybody should know, really, that the commentary you hear is the end of a week's work, or it's the tip of the iceberg, you know, it's the cherry in the cake and various other things, because you have to have done the work, the prep, to make you sound as if you know what you're talking about. I mean, there are certain sports where you'll have a large residual knowledge anyway, and there are others where you'll have to do more homework. But I think the key thing for me in terms of commentary is, as you say, that change of gear, a sort of sympathy for the sport that's happening in front of you, and whether you're able to follow it with the right tone of voice. And that change of tone of voice can be very, very subtle. But also, sport can be serious, and it can be dramatic, and it can be wonderful, but it can also be silly, it can be boring, it can be all of those things. It's not always dramatic, it's not always serious. So don't always treat it with these, you know, rather pompous, stentorian tones that behold the greatness of sport. Well, sometimes it's just a bit of nonsense, a bit of... So have that light and shade, have that change of gear, and don't always... Yeah, don't always... I don't know. There's a certain tone on certain stations that would say that this is the most important thing happening in the world today. Well, it might be a great match. It might be a fantastic sporting event. And it might matter a great deal, but there will also be within it, as I said, some very light-hearted moments. And at the end of the day as well, at the end of the day, use that sporting cliche, it is just sport. But having said that, sport is... As we know, you know, when you're without it, you realise just how important it is.
Yeah, and just that supplementary question, anyone out there in particular that you're particularly loving?
Oh, yeah. I would always love listening to John Murray, who I think is just brilliant, because he's so natural. That's what you hear when he's commentating as well, is just as he is. But he's got he can do the dramatic moments so well, but he can do... you can do very sort of very subtle whimsy and humour as well. Great descriptive powers. Yeah. So John would be... I mean, there are many. I mean, John Hunt's a brilliant commentator, Mike Costello as well. I would say I think it's... If you're a very good commentator, it's easier to shine on radio than television, because television, you're only doing... You're filling in, really, for the picture. The pictures are doing most of the work. and you're trying to augment them or trying to just assist them along the way. Whereas on radio, you are the pictures. So you've got to, and so the very best commentators really do stand out. And I think you have to have great talent to do the radio commentary. So there are so many I could name, but I think certainly if you give me a commentator to commentate on, to commentate for my life, I mean that would be weird, first of all. But yes, commentator to commentate on my demise would be John Murray. Yeah. Here goes Andrew Carter, off he goes, and John would be the commentator seeing me off.
Nice choice. Yeah, John is brilliant. And it's interesting, actually. I mean, you mentioned the likes of Mike Costello and John Hunt as well, who, these are people that I've managed to speak to. It would be great to speak to John Murray at some point as well. But I found it quite interesting that the people I've been drawn to, the names that feel most apparent to me, have often been a lot who are still within or close to the BBC stable. And although the likes of Nick Mullins, ex-BBC and at BT now, and I've spoken to Miles Harrison and you know, would love to speak to Martin Tyler and various others who are clearly very established broadcasters at other, in working for other companies. It is interesting to me that actually a lot of the people that we see as being at the top of their game are BBC trained and worked for a number of years, even though perhaps as the old institution that we've known and loved for so many years, bringing us our sport, hasn't as much sport as it used to have. But actually, the people that are bringing it are still so close to our hearts.
Yeah, exactly, because it did have all the sport, and there was so much scope for people coming through there, and so many BBC local radio stations as well. So that's where so many started. Mm. So yes, in terms of job opportunities 20 years ago when a lot of these people, 30 years ago, 40 years ago when some of these people were coming through, then the BBC had far more opportunities to give than commercial radio or television. So now, if you look in 10 years time, 20 years time, there'll be people who have done their entire careers in the commercial sector, because there is there's so much rugby on BT Sport, or so much golf on Sky Sports. So, and who knows who else is going to come into the picture in terms of Amazon Prime already making themselves felt. So there will be even more opportunity for people to commentate, but but they won't, 90% of them won't be coming through necessarily at the BBC. I mean, it is still a huge organisation, still has huge numbers of commentators, and still does sports so well, but there are just other kids on the block as well now.
Yeah. One question that's come up with a couple of other people, and I'm interested in your view, is how much you think a commentator's allowed an opinion. And we all know that the co-commentator is in theory the expert and the one who's perhaps going to talk about their insight. But ultimately, when they talk about 1,000 hours and experts in their field, commentator can have spent an awful lot of time with their chosen sport, and I think their opinion can be valid. But a lot of people say, your job's to call the action, we don't want to hear your opinion.
I think if something is very obvious, then then you go with it. But you're right. It's it's not me to say, well, that's a foul, or that should be a penalty. Mm. That is the job of the expert alongside you. But then those roles blur. When I'm doing golf, for example, we don't operate with one of us is an expert and one of us is not, even though Ken Brown and Peter Alice were both golfers, or whoever it might be. And I'm sitting there not the ex-golfer, but you can still say, if someone misses a 3-foot putt, you can still say that is, and you can see, I do have a certain amount of knowledge in certain sports where you can say, well, I mean, that's just a poor stroke or whatever. But even then you'd feel, well, maybe that isn't my job to say so. But if something is very obvious, then you can say it. And if you can hear the crowd all going in one direction, then jump on board with them. But get behind the view that's popular. That's my opinion. No, but you're right. It's an interesting dynamic, because sometimes the lines do become blurred, and people will say, especially when ex-sportsmen or women, as I say, are the lead commentators, because they might then feel the need to be the expert as well, whereas that isn't really their role. But I think there should be a certain amount of leeway for everyone. You're just nibbling into each other's roles just a little bit, but still at the same time knowing that the expert is there to provide the expertise.
Yeah. Okay. And just a couple more then, really. You talked about what you think is the key to becoming a good commentator. It's a similar vein, but would you have any advice to anyone who's listening who is wanting to become a commentator?
Well, things have changed so much now that, you know, if I were saying to a young kid, come on, fill him a lad.
A young buck.
Yeah, exactly. I would say, you know, we were all about getting your demo tapes together and sending them off and trying to get into local radio, whereas now anyone can broadcast on anything. So set up a YouTube channel, you know, and start offering content. It might be rubbish at first, but you'll get better, and then who knows what might happen with it. It's just... and I would listen to and watch sport as well, and just, as I said at the start, I was soaking in, you know, the commentary and the sound of sport when I was growing up. So, you know, you can do that as well by watching and listening to sport and seeing how it's done. But media is changing so much and so quickly that any advice I give now will be out of date in 5 years' time, because anybody can be a broadcasting channel themselves now. So we're not dependent so much. If I could go back 10 years, I would set up a YouTube channel and start doing that as well. Now, it would have been utter rubbish at first, but then you'd build up some sort of content and some sort of following, and then you wouldn't be dependent on companies losing sports rights or world pandemics. So... it's just I would say just practice and listen and enjoy watching sport and just see what you can. If you want to do it, I would say set something up yourself. Apply perhaps for jobs and work experience with others. But these conventional routes in are changing now, and I think being superseded by you just want to become an influencer. That's what you do. Get some ad revenue. Yeah. Get 10,000 followers and just get some ad revenue.
Just bully your way through. That's it. And we've mentioned the various things that obviously various sports that you've done. What would you like the chance to commentate on, perhaps, that you've never had the chance to?
That's a good one. I don't know. I once got asked if I'd want to do football, and I didn't have. It's a little bit like Mike was saying about the cricket. You know, I don't really have the passion for it, and football is obviously so keenly followed by so many millions that you know, I think you do have to have a real passion for it and a real expertise in it. But you know, you'd love to do you want to do the biggest events, don't you? That's the thing. You know, doing the opening ceremony in Rio was a thrill, and looking forward to Tokyo whenever that might happen. Now doing that again, that's always a thrill. So. I don't know. A football World Cup final, and then after 85 minutes, people go, "Hang on a minute, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about." But it doesn't matter because I've done the World Cup final. Yeah, I'd love to. Yeah, love to do a football World Cup final with Scotland playing against England. Do you think that's going to happen? Sure. When's that going to happen?
Of course, yes. We'll make that happen. One you might want to do, but in terms of then, you know, this is often my final question, not in a morbid sense, but you're given your chance to do your last call, your last big, it could be an event, a week, a weekend, or whatever it is. What would be your swan song event if that was to be the last thing before you put the mic down?
Another good question.
A football world. I always in Scotland.
Yeah, well, exactly. I don't know, things I've enjoyed doing most. I always got a great thrill out of doing, you know, and sometimes they're still live in the BBC, sometimes they're not anymore, but I always get a great thrill out of doing the Calcutta Cup in the Six Nations, or doing coming down the stretch in the Masters or the Open, or the Ryder Cup. But I would say, doing Olympic Games, there's something about an Olympic Games. It has many, many critics, but there's a great feeling of the world coming together as well. And, you know, that communal viewing experience, which you don't get so much anymore. You might have got it over a big Andy Murray match, you know, getting 16 million viewers or whatever, or a big Six Nations match, but getting a huge part of the country watching a big event and being able to call it and hopefully call it right. That would be good, yeah. There we are. 100 metres final in the Olympic Games, something like that.
There we go. Well, listen, you're a fantastic example of a multi-sport commentator out there for anybody that's looking to hear how it's done. And look, it's reassuring, I think, to everybody watching their sport to hear the words and Andrew Cotter. Keep up the great work, Andrew, and thank you so much for your time.
Thanks very much, Nick.
A tricky man to pin down due to how in demand Andrew is, but wasn't that wonderful? I loved hearing a bit more of the detail around that episode at the Stadio Olimpico. The poor bloke, honestly. And just fascinated to hear some of the different ways he approaches the various things he does. A truly great broadcaster of our time. So if you've enjoyed being back on the Q Commentator bus, I hope not to leave it so long until the next episode. Feel free to tell your mates if you liked it. Don't tell anyone if you didn't. Reviews are very welcome on iTunes as well. Please do that. It does help spread the word. And the more people there are, well, the more people others see that they're checking it out. Know what I mean? So if people see more people are there, you know what I mean. It would be lovely to get a review. So if you could take a minute to do that, that would be lovely. And thank you once more. I really mean that. Great to have you listening once again. And I hope to be with you again very soon. It's ciao for now. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.